I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation. American flag lapel pins are a frequent sight on politicians' coats. The implication is clear. The wearers believe they are showing their patriotism, or at least that's what they'd like others to believe. With deep partisan divisions across the country, there's also very different ideas of what it means to be a patriot. On this day before the nation's 241st anniversary, we thought we'd take a look at the idea of patriotism now. HPU history professor John Davidan joins us with some of his observations. Good to talk to you again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on, Beth Ann.
You've talked about five distinct epochs of patriotism within our country's history. What are they?
Right. So when we look at American history, of course, the first one is emerging patriotism during the Revolutionary period. The second one is contested patriotism during the Civil War. The third one, imperial patriotism during the late 19th century when the United States became an imperial power. The fourth one would be the 1960s patriotism really in crisis when flags were being burned, not worn on lapels. And then, of course, the present day, the fifth one, where patriotism, I would argue, is in decline or it has been eroded.
Why has it been eroded in ways now that we didn't see perhaps even in the 60s? Is that due to perhaps the fact that we are in a much more globalist society? People identify themselves a little differently these days?
Right. I think, of course, the process of globalization has been going on for a long time, maybe in the modern period since 1870, but it's really accelerated. And I think Americans became aware of that process in the 1990s under the Clinton administration, the rise of the Internet, email, wireless communication, and, of course, people traveling all over the world, global corporations. Globalization is not just a process. It's a way for people to identify themselves. And I think so you can identify with the American flag. You can identify with food in Japan or Korea. You can identify with a European pop star. So in an age of global communication, global trade, global exchange, I think it's really become more confusing for Americans to be patriots.
Once upon a time, if you said you were an American, that connoted something in the mind of the listener. That seems to be very different given what you've just said, that people can find their community at a touch of a button. So what does it mean now if someone says, I'm patriotic?
Right. Well, I still think there's a core meaning there that at least I would hope they know that patriotism is defined as love of country. And I would assume that's still a part of what they feel. But, you know, it has a lot of different meanings today. It has always had a lot of different meanings. The America First movement, that would suggest that that's an inherently patriotic movement. But, of course, the America First organization historically was also patriotic, but it excluded certain kinds of people and was very anti-Semitic. So, you know, patriotism is love of country, but it seems that in nations we've almost always divided between those who can be citizens and those who cannot. So there's this kind of double edge to patriotism.
We talk about rights a lot. People feeling that they have rights to things or being sold an idea of, for example, the American dream. Everybody should have a house. Everybody should have all kinds of things. Right. But that's seemingly at odds with what you've just said and what we see in history. How do we better write that ideal and couch it in terms of being patriotic?
Yeah. So I think there's some of this happening right now. When I talk to people who have been maybe in the past been identified as not being so patriotic, they're stepping up and saying, you know what, we need to be more patriotic because it looks like we're in a bit of a political crisis and, you know, a very divided nation. One way to bridge the divides of the nation is to identify with the history of the nation, with the positives of the nation. In terms of those who were previously left out of the nation and now are more a part of the nation, you know, groups like, you know, slaves or Native Americans.
Or the 442nd.
Or the 442nd, right. You know, that can be an expansion of patriotism. It doesn't have to actually go against patriotism.
So now, as we're about to celebrate this 241st anniversary of the founding of this country, and you mentioned that was the original patriotism, that still also comes with it a lot of baggage that we don't necessarily talk about, where not everybody had all of the rights as were originally envisioned, certain things that people feel are imbued within the Constitution that frankly may not be. And the Constitution is a very different document than, say, you know, what we saw with, you know, the Bill of Rights and what we saw, you know, very original thought and what had to be traded off to be able to even get the Constitution signed. We don't seem to remember those kinds of ideas when we talk about patriotism either.
Right. You know, the Constitution's a really important document, and for whatever flaws it has in it, of course, there are references to slavery in the Constitution. It seemed to enfranchise this elite of white males. Whatever those flaws are, the Constitution has evolved, and I think we should evolve our understanding with it. And foremost, I think we should understand it. There's a great full-page spread in the New York Times Sunday edition of the Constitution and politicians and scholars' comments on the Constitution and the way it's evolved. So it's a really powerful document. It's maybe the most successful political system in the history of the world based on this document. So we should definitely get a better understanding of the document.
But tomorrow we're going to celebrate the Declaration of Independence, which seems to be a much more pure document. If you just look at how it says what it says, it seems not to have some of those same issues that you just brought up about the Constitution.
That's true. You know, Abraham Lincoln, who was, of course, a great political leader and the president of the United States during the Civil War, he had a problem with the Constitution because the Constitution endorsed slavery by allowing slaves to be counted as part of the population. But he loved the Declaration of Independence. He loved its simplicity, its call to freedom. And so in that time period of contested patriotism, Lincoln expanded our notion of who could be patriotic. He expanded our notion of freedom. And that to me is a beautiful moment in the country, a moment that we should study and understand very well.
Would you suggest then that it might be a good idea tomorrow, notwithstanding, but to take a really good long look at the Declaration of Independence?
I think so. It's a beautiful document. It's a very interesting document. I mean, it's simple in the beginning, right, with the, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Those are great. And then it's also a critique of the British rule in the colonies, because Jefferson hated the Church of England. He hated the monarchy, and he condemns all of those in the back pages of the Declaration of Independence.
Well, we don't seem to talk about that very much, and we don't seem to import those ideas into perhaps our own ideas of patriotism or how it's evolved over these 241 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing about the Declaration of Independence, I think it's much more of a transcendent document than the Constitution, which was a series of compromises, as you noted. I think anything we can do to educate the American people about these two documents is really crucial.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in. Always good to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Beth Ann. Have a good 4th of July.
And you have a very happy 4th of July,
okay,
too.
Thanks.
John David Ann is professor of history at Hawaii Pacific University.
Support for The Conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, learning the ways of the Wayfinder at HCC. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, Ulehua, Unihau, Ukawa, Oahu, Umulokai, Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we got to thinking about one of the founding members of the Polynesian Voyaging Society. He was an artist whose historically accurate portrayals of key moments in Hawaiian history have been displayed at the Bishop Museum, Hawaiian Volcanoes National Park, Pūkohola-Heiau National Historic Site, and at the Hawaii State Capitol. He was born in Marshfield, Minnesota, in the U.S., and divided his time between Hawaii and Wisconsin when he was growing up. A childhood encounter with American painter D. Howard Hitchcock put him on the path of an artist, and he went on to earn a master's degree in art at the Institute of Chicago. He had a successful career in advertising. He moved to Hawaii and focused his work on pre-contact Hawaiian life. Some of his best-known paintings include The Battle of Nu'uanu'apali and Cook Entering Kealakekua Bay. Today, we're looking for his name, and we think you probably might know this one. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right will get the prize.
Hello, America. It's President Trump. And you know, the only thing that can get me off of social media is when I sit down and listen to the Capitol steps.
Every time the Donald goes,
tweet, tweet, tweet,
someone stop him.
Tweet, tweet, tweet,
can we block him?
Tweet.
So let's make America great again and listen to the Capitol steps for the July radio special right here on this public radio station.
Tuesday morning at 11 and Tuesday evening at 7.
Aloha, I'm Ai-Jen Poo, co-director of Caring Across Generations, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Ways of the Pacific Ocean navigators were almost lost to history until the voyages of the Hokulea and the growth of the Polynesian Voyaging Society brought them back to inspire new generations. Now the secrets of the ancient wayfinders are being taught in a college course. Polynesian Voyaging Society Captain Robert Perkins is inaugurating a non-credit course of instruction at Honolulu Community College in what he has learned as a voyaging canoe crew member, and he's with us in our studio. Hi, Bob. Thanks for coming.
Aloha mai. Thanks for having me.
I guess before you learn the real intricate arts of the wayfinder, you have to learn how to crew the boat, right?
That's very true. You got to figure out where you want to go before you can figure out how to get there.
Makes sense. So what kind of things are you teaching in this course?
Actually, the course was developed because we were looking for a crew to fill a lot of positions throughout the Malamahonua worldwide voyage. Mm-hmm. And we found that the community was really interested, whether they wanted to go on the va'a or not. Mm-hmm. And so we decided that we should just start training people, whether they wanted to go on the actual voyages or if they just wanted to get more information. So
sure.
That's how it started.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot more people who wanted to take part than knew how, right?
Many, many more, yeah. Of the 200 or so crew members that we actually use, we probably had 8,000 to 10,000 people that showed interest in wanting to become crew members. Yeah.
How long does it take to learn all the things you need to know?
Oh, my goodness. I'm still learning, and yeah. I've been at it for more years than I care to admit. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that we take people from all walks of life. So the people that get to crew on these va'a are not sailors. They're, mm-hmm. I use the term, doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs. It mm-hmm. doesn't matter. So mm-hmm. what we see is that a lot of it has to do with how much they want to learn.
Sure. Well, that's true of a lot of things, isn't it?
It is. It is very true.
At the same time, you know, a lot of people who are becoming sailors for the first time, it's difficult to have an idea of what it is you're getting into, right?
It truly is. And because we're at sea for sometimes 3 or 4 weeks, each crew member has a particular responsibility or kuleana that they have to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to train them not only on how to sail, but also how to do that particular kuleana.
Sure. It would probably be helpful to know a few other people's as well if you needed to fill in, right?
Indeed, and that is always can be a problem. If somebody gets ill, then somebody else has to fill in for that mm-hmm. for that person's position. Yeah, so we generally try to have two people that know each kuleana.
Sure. Well, you've got some decades of experience of trial and error behind you, don't you?
We do. And believe me, there was a lot of trial and error,
sure.
starting, of course, with the first voyage to Tahiti in 1976, mm-hmm. which is interesting. It was the bicentennial of the United States. And then, of course, when we lost Eddie Aikau,
yeah.
Which, by the way, was the only person that we have ever lost.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an exciting time, exciting learning, and I think someday we'll actually know what we're doing.
Well, that's true of any art and science. You know, this is sort of art and science combined, isn't it?
It is indeed, yeah. The wayfinding, the non-instrument navigation is a natural science, I like to look at it, because we don't use any instruments, although we use our natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the stars, we'll use the sea, we'll use the birds, to find out exactly how far we have gone and hopefully where we are headed.
I've heard that before about birds. What's an example of things that birds tell us?
There are certain birds that will leave islands in the morning and fly out, and perhaps they'll fly out 20 or 30 miles. And
mm-hmm.
if we see them fly in the afternoon, we know that they're going back to that island. So
uh-huh.
that gives us a real good indication of where an island is, as opposed, let's say, to an albatross that can stay at sea for months on end.
Yeah.
And so we don't use them, obviously, because they're not telling us anything.
So if you see certain birds, you're within 20, 30 miles of them.
Some birds will go further, but for the most part, when we start seeing birds, we're getting pretty excited, yes.
It's sort of it's at least a ballpark.
It is, indeed, yes, yes.
What about just the view of waves that you get? What can wave directions and wave tops tell us?
Well, generally, the waves are generated by winds, and generally the winds give the waves a fetch or a direction and a height and a duration that we can use, and they're fairly consistent, and that's what we're looking for. We're looking for consistency.
Mm-hmm.
So if we see a ground swell that's moving from east to west, we can use that to determine our direction based on that groundswell.
It's often baffled me that the Europeans navigators either knew little of this type of navigation, but also from what I've seen in history, displayed fairly little curiosity about it.
Yeah, I've never read anything where Cook's crew or even Cook asked the people of Hawaii, the people of Polynesia, well, how did you get here?
Yeah.
They made comments on their vessels, on the canoes themselves, as to their speed and as to their strengths. But I have never read anything that said that anybody asked them how they got there.
Which is kind of remarkable when you think about it. It really is.
It really is. I mean, 10 million square miles of ocean and all of it habited. How did people get there?
Yeah.
It's baffling to me that Cook, in all of his wisdom, wouldn't ask that question.
Well, a very popular theory advanced by Thor Heyerdahl, I guess, in the 50s in Kon-Tiki, was that it was somewhat accidental. And that prevailed for quite a while, didn't it?
It did indeed. It did indeed. And I think what a lot of us say is that Thor Heyerdahl proved that people could get from South America to Polynesia. I do not believe, and I'm sure most people now do not believe, that that's how colonization occurred.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
Well, it's sort of, we've come in the world of formal education to place a greater value on indigenous knowledge, it would seem.
I think that's very true. I think that's very true, and I think that it's so easy to see how the Hawaiians and the Polynesians could get to these islands simply because they knew the wind patterns. They, of course, studied the skies, and so it stands to reason that they would get to these other islands.
Yeah. It's really a remarkable accomplishment, isn't it, Bob?
Indeed. It truly is.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Captain Robert Perkins is the director of Honolulu's Marine Education and Training Center and associate professor at Honolulu Community College and a captain volunteer with the Polynesian Voyaging Society. He'll teach an 8-week course in the techniques of the Polynesian navigator and the skills of crew members this summer at the Marine Education and Training Center on Sand Island. The course will be taught over 15 sessions, and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Millions of years ago, Hawaii endemic plants began their lives. Today, one exploratory botanist is trying to save them. Politics and opinion editor Chad Blair has a reality check. Hey, Chad.
Hello, Beth Ann.
Hey, these are the plants that we're talking about that came here via the ocean, via wind, maybe by a migratory bird, things that have been here literally for millions of years, and the ones that in many cases have been going away. Who is this botanist, and to what length is he going to save some of these plants?
A fascinating guy. The story, which is by Flux Hawaii, is up on our website today. His name's Steve Perlman. He's an exploratory botanist. And the story opens up. I mean, this guy is 69 years old, and yet here he is hanging on a vertical cliff above Kalalau Valley on Kauai. And it's quite frightening, but the reason he's there is because that's where these wild plants exist, where they're found nowhere else on Earth. But the alarming thing, of course, is that Hawaii is the most endangered species capital of the world. And so out of the 1,300 or so native plants that are on these islands, 130 of them are already extinct. So Steve Perlman's job is to find them, to try and protect them and keep them from the elements so that they continue to thrive.
So, Chad, what does it mean to save them? Are we talking about culling seeds, culling seedlings? What is he doing exactly?
Well, certainly he's trying to protect them from plant disease. You know, there's a lot of invasive species, both plant and animal, that come here. There's extreme weather conditions. That's more difficult. But if you can take a wild plant and somehow help it survive and then maybe replant it, there's also goats that get up there. They're able to climb these mountains. You know, there's things like, as many of us are starting to discover, some of these plants could have medicinal powers. There's possibility of that, and they also really keep our ecosystem intact. They help stabilize the climate and the shelter. So the idea is to protect them and to make sure that they continue to survive, and that does include culling their seeds and planting them and then replanting them.
Has he found any plants that we thought were extinct and then he miraculously found some?
Well, there is one in particular, the Plantago. God, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Plantago or Plantago princeps. It's a little tree. It's one that has been endangered, and now it's doing a little bit better. He says, we don't tend to think of plants quite the same way as other species that are endangered. Think about polar bears and pandas, right? They're cute. They're cuddly. You want to save them. You don't think that way about plants. But Steve Perlman takes it very personal. He did describe finding the very last survivor of another plant. And I can't pronounce the name. Sorry. But his reaction was, well, he went into depression and he actually pulled the plant out by its roots and went to a bar and had a drink and toasted the plant right there. Called his wife and told him he was going to be home late because that's how serious they take this mission, how personal it is to them.
Wait. You got to explain that. He pulled it out by its roots. Are you saying to plant it and keep it someplace else, or it was already
in bad condition. Mm-hmm. It was not going to make it, and he was mainly mourning the death of this single survivor. And it was he says sometimes folks in his business, they're on Prozac. They're depressed because of their industry. And yet guys like Steve Perlman still at age 69 climbing vertical cliffs on Kauai to try and protect these plants.
Where is he going to go next?
Oh, he will find other things. But for now, he's working for us. He's working for the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources. And we have employed him here to help protect our flora, our native flora and fauna. And it's a great story up on our website today.
Well, hopefully he won't have to go and have a wake for too many more plants. Thanks, Chad.
Thank you, Bethann.
Have a happy 4th of July, and we'll talk to you later in the week. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring politics and opinion editor Chad Blair.
Aloha, I'm Aiden James from Honolulu. Join the conversation on Twitter, talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Women peace activists from Hawaii have recently returned from the 9th International Women's Network Against Militarism. They joined representatives from other U.S. states, plus Puerto Rico, Korea, Japan, Okinawa, the Philippines, and Guam. Their task was to share information about the human and environmental costs of U.S. militarism and the role of women's nonviolent resistance. Unite Here Local 5 community organizer Lisa Grandinetti was among them. We talked last week after she arrived home about the work this group of women activists sees for itself and why they met in Okinawa.
Well, I think it's increasingly important, and it has always been very important for women to come together from around the world, because U.S. imperialism and the U.S. military has reached to every part of the world, and hence the group being active since 20 years ago. And in Okinawa, there's a lot of aspects of militarization that we all see in our own nation. So in Hawaii, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, all of these places, we see the same problems of sexual violence, of degradation of the environment, cultural effects. So it was very important to have it in Okinawa, especially right now, because several bases are expanding and the fight against Henoko, against Takai, are heating up right now.
How are they heating up in ways that we haven't heard?
A small group of us who are interested in these issues can see the news coming out of Okinawa rather clearly, because they have a lot of press coverage. But being there was just a whole different experience, because we got to see the physical space that's being threatened, feel that energy that's coming from it and from the people that have been fighting to protect it for over 10 years now. It was just a very meaningful experience to actually be there and meet the people who have been holding down the line for not just these past 10 years, but who have been involved since the Battle of Okinawa 72 years ago.
How would you describe that feeling of being there compared to what it is that the rest of us see in various reports?
Well, for me in particular, my mom is from Okinawa, and I'm Uchinanchu, or Okinawan. It was a very emotional experience. We went to Henoko on June 25th. It's commemoration of the start of the construction, which started on April 25th of this year. And they did a march in the water on boats. And it was very emotional to see the police and some private security that was hired just completely prohibiting the protesters from even entering this huge zone in the bay that's marked off for construction. And to see aunties and uncles that have been there for a long time chanting, speaking to these workers about how we stand for peace in Okinawa, and that's what it really means to be Okinawan. It was heartbreaking, but at the same time, just so inspiring to see Okinawans continue to stand for peace and against violence that the military causes.
Those nonviolent actions that brought all of you together to be able to devise, to create, to participate in, as you just talked about, what happened in Okinawa. What about in other places in the world? What have you planned for that?
So we talked about different themes around militarization. We talked about military violence against women, environmental destruction and discrimination, creating alternative economies, and imagining a more genuine security. All the women are going back to their homes to continue their work against specific issues. So like in the Philippines, one of the biggest issues is prostitution around the bases or in the bases, and especially overseas workers. So women are sent with entertainer visas to Korea to work in bars, and then they're essentially trafficked into prostitution. So that's one thing that women are organizing around. They're actually
rooting, in the Philippines.
Yes, they're. I met these amazing women who have this organization called Buklod, which means like solidarity and strength and unity. They go into the bars, and all of them are survivors of trafficking themselves, and they actually organize and recruit leaders from those sex workers, and they provide services, but they are very politically engaged. So that's just one example of what's happening, but it really demonstrates the value of the network, because the same kind of work is happening in Korea with those migrant workers. So that's just one example. But in Hawaii, we really want to focus on issues like Pohakuloa. And something that's coming up next year is RIMPAC. So it's again, a very good demonstration of the necessity to be in solidarity internationally, because all the nations were actually represented in our network. They're coming to Hawaii for this meeting about military weapons. Corporations will be there as well. They'll be. It's basically the coming together of exactly the things that we were coming together against.
How do you feel that women today may be better or less able to deal with some of the issues that brought together the group in Okinawa? We've seen feminism move through various different waves, and there's been some criticism, and there's also been answers to that criticism about what feminism can do today. Mm-hmm. You consider yourself to be an intersectional feminist.
Yes.
How do you see that playing into the role of women around the world in the way that you came together to counter militarism and other issues that are specifically targeted at women?
I think it's very important for, and I, not in an essentialist way where I don't want to imply that all women have the same experiences, because they don't. There's questions of indigeneity and race and class and geography that need to be that need attention as well, and that produce differences. But we see that women and children really experience the brunt of military violence, especially with the bases that cover the entire earth. I participated in the group discussion about sexual violence, and it is such a it really is kind of the epitome of dominance, that's really key to militarism and imperialism. So I think looking at solutions to sexual violence and imperialism, women really should be at the forefront, because we are the ones that are surviving in ways that are sort of invisibilized. I always think whenever approaching an issue of discrimination and injustice, the people experiencing that discrimination and injustice need to be at the forefront of efforts against it.
And yet, in many cases, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that transition from the place around the world that many women may hold it in not being as engaged as you would like them to, in fact, being at the forefront, or at least being at the table?
Mm. I think it really, I don't think women don't want to be involved, but rather pushed out of positions of power and kept out. And that's where my work with the union has really, with Local 5, has really given me a vision for what leadership can look like and should look like and does look like. Our union is 80% women. Service work is very feminized. And we have leaders that reflect our membership. Our leadership is full of women, women of color, immigrant women. And I think what it's going to take to get to a place where women are at the table and also leading the movement against all forms of violence and injustice is organizing and building power and building leadership, which is why I mentioned Buklod, which is the Filipino organization, because they are doing exactly that. I'm actually recruiting leadership from those women who are experiencing violence directly from the U.S. military and imperialism.
Lisa Grandinetti, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa Grandinetti is an intersectional feminist and a community and labor organizer with Unite Here Local 5, where she interned as a high school student. She recently graduated from UH Manoa.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
The different programs that are on at different times in public radio, it's like different colors in a palette, and you can paint whatever you want by picking the hours that you want to listen. And you may want to go for the dark colors of Rembrandt or the bright colors of Monet, but it's your choice how you paint that landscape with those colors, with the different shows you listen to through the day.
Member supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
Next time on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll learn how scientists are fighting rapid ohia death.
We'll learn about new survey and detection tools being used to identify areas for treatment and fight the devastating outbreak.
That's next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet, plus what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. We've got him on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. So this week, stargazers, Mars can be seen in the western sky after sunset, where it will set at around 8 p.m. Jupiter and Saturn can be seen right through till the early morning. Our moon this week is on its way to being full.
Now, this week, we are headed to South America.
Yeah, this week, a quite frankly astonishing set of data from the ALMA submillimeter telescope in Chile. ALMA has produced a stunning image of the nearby super red giant star Betelgeuse, commonly referred to as Betelgeuse, in the constellation of Orion the Hunter. This massive red star is easily visible from Earth during the fall and winter, and it's even possible to make out its red-orange color with the human eye. But despite being only 650 light-years away, detailed images of this star have proved frustratingly elusive until now.
Even with the biggest telescopes, we don't get really good images of stars, right?
Yeah, it's one of the weird things about observational astronomy. We're all used to seeing beautiful images of grandiose galaxies in far corners of the universe, and even beautiful cloud-like nebula closer to home. But it's really, really difficult to get a decent image of any star.
Is that because their size, they're a lot smaller than galaxies and nebula?
Yeah, that's precisely why it's so hard to get an image. But because Betelgeuse is so big and relatively close, ALMA was able to capture it.
And Betelgeuse is the one that's going to explode at any time, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. This is what's really exciting about it. Super red giant stars like Betelgeuse don't last long. They live for a fraction of the time that our own sun would live for, about a few million years. Because they are so massive, they end their lives in supernovae, the largest explosions in the cosmos.
And is this the kind of thing we're going to see it when it happens, or we'd have to be here in a couple million years?
Oh, no, totally. It's going to be visible from the Earth, and because Betelgeuse is overdue, it could happen anytime within the next few hundred years. It could even happen next week.
And there's no threat from this either, right?
No, nothing at all. It's too far away to do us any harm, but it will make for a star that can be seen during the day.
Well, let's hope it happens in the next 50 or 60 years, let's say. Christopher Phillips and another fun stargazer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a former commercial illustrator who became one of the most prominent artists of the Hawaiian Renaissance and was a founder of the Polynesian Voyaging Society. His works were celebrated for their historical accuracy as well as their artistic merit, and became part of the resurgence of pride in Hawaiian history that characterized the Renaissance. He designed 7 stamps for the U.S. Postal Service, including stamps for the 25th and 50th anniversaries of Hawaii's statehood. United States Senator Daniel Inouye once said, "When you saw a Herb Kane painting, you were energized and motivated to learn about the past." His artwork captured both ancient and modern-day Hawaii and helps preserve Hawaii's unique culture for future generations. And that's the name we were looking for today, Herbert Kauai Nui Kane.
Bill Ruffin called us from Honolulu, knew the answer, and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a Backyard Quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org, and we just might use it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Learn more about new product and training updates for Hawaii schools at achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Kids spend a lot of time and energy figuring out who they are and where they fit in, and the process of adapting to the group is not always an easy one. The kids' musical Honk Jr. is designed for them. It's the classic Ugly Duckling story with singing and dancing. Swain Kawe is directing a new actors group production, and he's with us in our studio. Hi, Swain. Thanks for coming in.
Aloha, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Like a lot of children's stories, it's a fun story with a pretty serious heart to it.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, I was blown away and amazed as I was researching what show to choose. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is a hidden gem. It's not your Disney over, you know, tons of movies made and whatnot.
Right.
But it's won a lot of awards in the musical theater world. Mm-hmm. And the story that it tells with the type of music that it has is absolutely amazing for both adults and youth alike.
You know, we've got a society that has veered very strongly toward judging by appearances. Fair to say?
Oh, my goodness, yes. And this is exactly the main theme in this show.
Yeah.
In fact, you look at the poster and it looks like a little kid's poster. It's about Ugly Duckling. Mm-hmm. And you think, you know, it's just going to be your typical little, you know, kid's play. Mm-hmm. But absolutely not. They don't have feathers on them, even though they represent animals. They're really representing the human condition. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the duck yard and you learn all about them, really, it's society. It's the community. Each one of them has their own niches and places. And they all gang up and beat up verbally Ugly. And that's very representative of our society in some ways.
Sad but true, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, I would think that especially when they're not, without feathers, even a four-year-old is going to know what you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely, especially when you see them get hatched. You know, I mean, it's so funny how it does play this line between the human condition and the animal world.
Uh-huh.
But yes, they get born, and they get born during the song The Joy of Motherhood, uh-huh. You know, and there's so much humor that it's so funny to teach these young cast members you know, what these adult jokes are, you mm-hmm. know, and how do you play this mother of like, why do we sit on this nest all day and do what we do? And and then the friend has to come in and, you know, it's because it's about the looking at your brood and the mm-hmm. little steps, you know, and the joys of motherhood. And then next thing you know, they're being hatched. And sure enough, everyone is ecstatic.
You know, frequently the authors of plays and movies for children kind of try to please everyone. And you know, a lot of the animated movies for kids that I've seen are full of sort of snarky jokes that go right over the heads of kids.
Yes.
To the point where I wonder what they're doing there, except they know that parents have to come along to buy the movie ticket. But
right. But I think you're absolutely right. That's probably put there for a certain generation or for a certain group of people. And I consider that to be actually really good writing when you can hit a genre, you know, a bunch of different groups of people in society. Mm-hmm. You know, teaching a youngster the joke in it's my party and I'll cry if I want to. I had to play the song for him. I had to show him what that was because his joke is it's my party and I'll fly if I want to, fly if I want. And to get him to understand it. But once he did, uh-huh. Oh, boy, is he on fire. He loves it.
So there's a certain amount of that jokes addressed both at adults and kids in
yes.
the show.
So one of the big reasons why I chose this show was because it connected with me. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, I was bawling. So I listened to it again and I read through it again and I was crying. And so I connected to it. I said, okay, this is what we'll do. It'd be good for our students. It'll be good for the community. And it's something I'm connected to, so I can get it out of me artistically.
If you know that there's an emotion to be found there and you felt the emotion, that's... You're more than halfway there, aren't
oh,
you?
Oh, yeah. And you really feel for Ugly at certain times. He does, because he's clueless, you know, and in so many ways, many of us are, you know, not trying to do bad things. So we're clueless to how life can beat us up sometimes, you know.
Well, you know, everybody's got a little Ugly in him somewhere, right?
Oh, yes.
I mean, who does adapt to the perceived images of society.
Absolutely right.
Nobody I've ever known.
Yeah, and now you've got your finger right on top of another show I love, next to Normal. What is Normal? Mm-hmm. You know, and this is the beauty of art and what it can carry and the message it carries, whether it's youth who are literally second graders who've barely learned how to walk, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. all the way up to professional adults. The power behind what live performance in theater can do is absolutely amazing.
Well, this is a pretty important thing for kids to learn because they can get really caught up in the thing of being excluded.
Oh, yes. Oh,
and they
yes.
can exclude, you know.
Oh, yes.
They can get kind of mean sometimes.
Very mean. And in fact, that's the show showcases that. His siblings are the cutest little ducklings ever to be hatched, mm-hmm. but they're actually the nastiest little group of ducklings. Mm-hmm. But they're so cute that they're, you know, you don't hate them. but, you know, you enjoy them.
But you would sort of perhaps identify with that sort of, or at least recognize that mean thing that happens.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, it's really interesting to talk about our kids really quickly, because how this program became created was between the Hongwanji Mission School's Performing Arts, HMS mm-hmm. Performing Arts, mm-hmm. and then reaching out to TAG, the actors group, and finding a beautiful middle. And so we came together and created this program called Stage Left. Mm-hmm. And so this is the inaugural year. We have 47 kids, students, performers. Wow. They go through a six-week musical intensive. Uh-huh. They learn audition, I mean, nonstop between 11 and 4:30. Uh-huh. I just have them going nonstop, dancing. We have a great team. Uh-huh. Nani Lisa Pascual is the musical director. Mariva Menembri is the choreographer. Jason Taglianetti is the sound designer. We have a lot great team, and these kids are absolutely amazing.
Well, it sounds as if you're creating some future theater talents in there.
That, I hope so, and really along the lines of Ron Bright. If they're not going to be talents, let them be good people in society and inspired by the arts.
That's a great legacy, isn't it?
Amen.
Thanks a lot, Swain.
Thank you.
Swain Cowie is the director of Honk Junior, an actors group, and Hongwanji Mission School, a combined production that will be performed July 14th and 15th at 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. in Maluhia Hall at the Honolulu Myohoji Mission in Honolulu. Details are on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
That's going to do it for us today. Just a quick note, we're preempted for the 4th of July holiday, so we'll see you on Wednesday. Brad Glosserman of Pacific Forum CSIS will look at American travel to North Korea.
And you could email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or you can reach Beth Ann at BKOZHPR.
If you want to find out more things about our show or to hear this one or another one again, just check out The Conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Wednesday with more of The Conversation.